This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Finally, a shaky roadmap towards sustainability in troubling times. I'm Alex, and this week we go for the transition movement, West Coast style. What started with Rob Hopkins in the village of Totnes, England, is evolving in North America. We'll hear from early adapters in Colorado, Los Angeles, and Vancouver. Our guests are Michael Brownlee from Boulder, Joanne Poirot from Village LA, and Vandy Savage from Vancouver. We'll top that off with speakers at a Village Vancouver meetup, Ann Pacey and Ross Moster. It's crammed full of ideas for your own action plan. If oil becomes expensive like gold or stops coming, if the climate shifts, if the economy falls apart, these neighborhoods are working now to keep going. Community building, transition towns, all coming your way next on Radio EcoShock. The transition movement has spread from the United Kingdom to North America. And Michael Brownlee is a gateway for many people discovering this new vision of living and community building. Brownlee co-founded Transition Colorado. Michael, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. Glad to be here.
Michael, just to let listeners know what to expect, I'd like to suggest a game plan. Let's start with a brief explanation of what transition is. That can take hours, I know, but let's try for a few minutes. Then we'd like to hear from your seminal article in Transition Times, The Evolution of Transition in the U.S. A little history first, before we dive into the new proposals for deep transition. If we have time, I'd like to end up with stories from Transition Colorado, a few on-the-ground examples of what people are doing. So, for the many listeners who already know about climate change and peak oil, what is the transition movement?
Well, the transition movement is about preparing our communities for the local impacts of these global crises like climate change and fossil fuel depletion or peak oil and economic decline as well. Because what's happened over the last 60, 70 years especially is as the economy has become increasingly globalized, our communities have lost their capacities to meet their own essential needs locally. So the transition movement is about relocalization, finding ways to make it possible for our communities to regain those capacities again. And the movement started in the UK just over 4 years ago in Totnes, England, where Rob Hopkins, a longtime permaculture teacher, decided to see if he could create a community-wide process in that little town for relocalization. And he mapped out a process in his experience there, which other communities have begun to pick up around the world. And the movement has, much to his surprise, grown quite rapidly in maybe 15 or 16 different countries now. So it's spread. And one of the reasons that it's important is that it's the first thing that any of us have seen, I think, that give us a sense that there is a process, that there is a pathway that we can bring to our communities to move towards relocalization, to make the transition off of fossil fuel dependence and become much more resilient and self-reliant. So that, in a nutshell, is what the transition movement is about.
How did this British initiative appear in the U.S., and what existing institutions did it build on?
Well, it began in the U.S. because there were several of us, many communities in this country and others, that were attempting relocalization, although we were quite clear that we didn't know how to do it. Many of us had been inspired by Post Carbon Institute, founded by Julian Darley, who had begun this idea of a relocalization network. But by the time Rob Hopkins and his transition process came along, we were all pretty hungry for a methodology, a pathway towards relocalization. So we had been watching what he was doing over there, and I finally went over in, I guess it was early 2008, to see for myself if all the good rumors about transition were true. I went through a two-day transition training in Scotland and made my pilgrimage down to Totnes, England to meet with Rob Hopkins and some of the other leaders there, and saw what was happening in the UK, was very excited and inspired by it, and felt that this had to come to the United States. So I and several other people in the U.S. here began organizing, reshaping our relocalization work around transition. And our organization here in Boulder, Colorado, actually became the very first officially recognized transition initiative in North America. And it's spread since that time, of course. There are now, I think, 79 officially recognized transition initiatives in the U.S. And we don't know how many, but probably another couple hundred that are what the movement likes to call mullers, those who are considering utilizing the transition process in their communities.
Could you just name some of the larger or more advanced places in the U.S. that are taking on this transition challenge?
Let's see. Transition Sandpoint, Idaho is maybe the farthest along of the new crop of transition initiatives. They did their Great Unleashing Big Public event in November of 2008, and they're now working on their Energy Descent Action Plan for their community. So they seem to be very strong, but it's a small community of about 8,000 people, much like Totnes. On the other end of the spectrum is, believe it or not, Transition Los Angeles, which is addressing not just the city of L.A., but the whole L.A. basin of, you know, 14 million people or so. It's a huge challenge, but there are a number of very, very committed people there who are taking the lead and inspiring neighborhoods and smaller communities in the L.A. area to join together in this transition process. So those are the ends of the scale, and then we see many other cities in between. Ann Arbor is strong. Bloomington, Indiana is strong. Many other communities across the country. There's a new initiative that's really strong showing up down in Sarasota, Florida. We're glad to see the Southeast starting to move in this direction. Those are some of the ones that are doing well out there.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, here with Michael Brownlee, the co-founder of Transition Colorado. Michael, why do you think the transition movement, as envisaged by Rob Hopkins and others in the UK, might have to be modified to work in America?
Well, I think we're discovering, as we attempt to enroll communities in the transition model or the transition process, that the U.S. is different. Our culture is different. Our history is different. Our mindset is different here. Some of the aspects of transition that were created in the UK need to be adapted more here. For instance, the transition work as it's defined by Rob Hopkins in the Transition Handbook speaks really to peak oil and climate change as the primary challenges, does not mention the economic situation that we're facing. And I think that we have felt that more painfully here in the U.S. than they have in the U.K. Until fairly recently. So we have felt from early on that we had to include that in our presentation, help people to understand what's happening with the economy and the kind of impact that that might have on their communities and their own lives. There are other cultural differences that I think are important. For instance, in the UK, this is just my observation, and I'm sure other people may see this differently, but I sensed when I was over there a greater sense of community than we have in this country. You know, my observation about the U.S. has been for a long time that community has, you know, it's maybe our scarcest and most endangered resource here. And communities have been kind of hollowed out by economic globalization, and so our culture has been experiencing a kind of silo effect. So people are not accustomed to working together and collaborating and cooperating and co-creating in the form of a movement. You know, they're much more focused on individual efforts, individual lifestyles. So it's harder to catalyze a grassroots movement here in this country, it seems, than it is in the UK. We also noticed in the UK that there is a greater curiosity about the facts, the realities of fossil fuel depletion, the realities of climate change. You know, when I saw public presentations over there, people had many, many questions, penetrating, in-depth questions. In this country, it seems like we're maybe a little less interested in the facts. We're much more interested in opinions. So that makes it difficult to present some of these ideas. So those are just a few of the things that I think compel us to adapt the transition model to our own culture. And in fact, I think that it has to be adapted to every community, because every community is unique. It has its own unique challenges. And while there are principles and guidelines in transition that are certainly applicable anywhere, just as in permaculture, for instance, how transition is implemented in a community will vary from community to community. There's one other thing that happens here sometimes in the United States, and that is if something is invented across the ocean, we try to implement it exactly as it is. You know, Rob Hopkins is obviously brilliant. He's a great leader and the movement is growing, so we'll do it just like they did. And we discover, oh, it doesn't work that way. We need to take greater responsibility for adapting and evolving this transition process ourselves. And I think that that's true across the movement.
I have to agree. You know, I was at a meeting of Village Vancouver, and they're even looking at the differences between different parts of the city and how they would adapt. And everybody has to come up with their own plan. We've got a bunch of tools on the bench, but you've got to pick out what really works where you are. The other thing I was thinking about as I was thinking about this interview is just fast-moving events right now in the Middle East. We have a situation in Egypt where, we presume with the transition movement there's going to be a lot of time to make this transition, but within a week in Egypt, the police disappeared, the banks are closed, the ATMs are empty, a lot of problems in a short period of time. We hope that doesn't happen here, but I wonder, you know, how can the transition movement take into account the possibility of a sudden change?
Well, I think that that's one of the tensions between some of the leaders of the transition movement in this country and those in the UK. I think that we clearly have a greater sense of urgency here than they do there. I think that's partly a cultural phenomenon, but in any case, we feel that it's crucial to look at the short-term potential for some of these kinds of problems. The transition process, as it's been defined, takes a while to implement. I mean, in Totnes, England, where this all began, they just, I think, early last year, finally published their Energy Descent Action Plan, and it took them nearly 4 years to get to that point, and they're just at the beginning stages of attempting to implement that plan. And so other communities are looking at this and seeing, gosh, if it took them that long, it looks like it might take even longer here. Do we have that much time? And so people like Richard Heinberg have been pleading for transition initiatives to say, of course, we need to be looking at the long-term planning here, but we also need to develop scenarios for the short term as well, because we could see dramatic price spikes in oil, or even temporary outages, shortages in oil. We could see the rising global food crisis begin to hit home in parts of this country. And in fact, that's beginning to happen in some places, especially to those who don't have a high level of income. There are other things that certainly could happen, weather events, terrorism events, but we're not well prepared to be resilient to be able to withstand whatever shocks may come in the short term. So we increasingly are encouraging people to develop short-term contingency plans as well as the longer-term planning process. And where that really comes home, I think, for a lot of people is in their own personal preparation. I mean, doing the things that Chris Martinson, for instance, is recommending, that we all have a reasonable supply of food and water and other essentials in case of emergency, so that if something significant happens in the short term, we're not completely vulnerable, but we'll actually be in a position where we can assist in our communities.
Yeah, I'm taking some of those steps myself. I do agree with the Mormons about having a year's worth of food if you can, and I think I have that much, but probably I would just end up feeding most of my neighbors with it, and I've gotten to know my neighbors, and I think that's another really important step in the short-term planning. Would you agree?
I absolutely agree. I think that that's wonderful. Certainly the model that we have seen from the Mormons and a few others is very relevant to us now. They've learned a lot about how to prepare for challenging times, and I think many of us need to take those lessons to heart, not only on an individual level, but also at a community level. So we're seeing, for instance, a greater interest in building on the Mormon model of community canneries, for instance. I think that this will be really essential in the future that we localize food processing, because we're going to need to be able to eat locally year-round. And without that kind of food processing and storage, we're not going to be able to do that. So there is a movement underway to develop that kind of infrastructure that can help us be resilient.
And it can also save you money in tough economic times. This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is transition teacher Michael Brownlee. Well, Michael, you have called for something called deep transition. Talk to us about this and take a few minutes to explain what you mean by that.
Sure. Let me just say that where this has emerged for us is out of the work of doing training for transition leaders. The other co-founder of Transition Colorado, Lynette Marie Hanthorne, and I are certified trainers in the Transition Network, and we have been doing these trainings, 2- and 3-day trainings around the country. And as we've been working with this and working with our own initiative and others in Colorado and other initiatives across the country, we're seeing, well, first of all, you can't expect people to learn how to relocalize a community over a 2-day workshop. This is an enormous challenge that we're all facing in relocalizing our communities. And I'm now talking about those who are already either leaders or part of an initiating group in a transition initiative, or those who want to be. I'm not just talking about the general public here. But for those people who find themselves deeply called to this work of catalyzing relocalization and transition in their communities, they need tools and perspectives and processes and experiences that will support them in this work. So just getting people inspired and excited and somewhat informed is not adequate. We feel that these people need much, much more. There are other tools and processes besides what's being currently offered in the transition movement that we think are going to be increasingly essential for those leaders. And so deep transition is about bringing in some of those other processes and perspectives and tools and making them available to transition leaders. And that includes things like the perspective of new cosmology or the universe story first presented by Thomas Berry and Brian Swim, which is a science-based understanding of the process of evolution of the universe itself, which allows us to really connect to the underlying processes of life. And this gives us really important clues to how we can move in our communities to catalyze what is essentially transition or relocalization is essentially an evolutionary process. You know, we're learning we can't make transition happen in our communities. we can only be catalysts for transition. How do we learn that? So we bring in some other perspectives like spiral dynamics. It gives us tools for understanding different people's consciousness as they're being confronted by these challenges and these opportunities, and how we can help them to respond. So this helps us a lot in trying to build a grassroots movement, understanding where people are so that we're not creating something that's divisive in our communities. There are many other pieces to it. An aspect of it, I would say, is what we think of as the inner transition work, or sometimes called heart and soul. This is understanding that, you know, we all have been deeply affected by what I will call the industrial growth society. It is a mindset, it is a paradigm that has actually created the predicament that we all find ourselves in collectively today. And because of that paradigm, we all to a degree have become separated from nature, disconnected from natural processes of life. We have been disconnected from each other. We have been disconnected from the deeper aspect of our own souls, even. So for this work to be truly resilient, truly sustainable, we feel that these things need to become reconnected. So a lot of the work in deep transition is about that and making that possible. You know, some people speak of the importance of decolonizing our minds from the industrial growth society, and that's a process that we're all going through. We're all waking up. We're all learning what the greater realities are that we're living in. So maybe I'll stop there and just say that deep transition is an exploration of what we most need to know and understand and experience in order to be what we think of as evolutionary catalysts in this time to help heal and regenerate our communities.
Getting our feet back on the ground, Michael, tell us what is happening in Colorado.
Well, in Transition Colorado, our focus here is our transition work primarily is focused on revitalizing the local food and farming system. We feel that food is the area where we are most vulnerable because we're so dependent on external resources. In Boulder County, for instance, we spend $700 million a year on food. Less than 1% of that is for locally produced food. So it's radically out of balance, which makes us very vulnerable and economically very weak. So we're working to rebuild food and farming here through awareness-raising campaigns, through investment funds, through Eat Local Week, through an Eat Local resource guide and directory, a magazine that we publish here. Lots of events, lots of reskilling, getting people involved in gardening and raising chickens and bees and goats and being responsible for raising some of their own food. Learning those fundamental life skills that were kind of taken for granted by our parents and great-grandparents, but somehow we didn't inherit. So that's the primary focus for us. And part of it is to bring in the awareness that rebuilding our food and farming system here may be the most important thing that we can do in terms of economic development locally, in terms of contributing to reducing our greenhouse gas emissions and contributing to the health of our children and the health of our communities. And this is happening for many transition initiatives. This has become a major focus for our work here. So that's just one aspect.
If people want to find out more, what resources do you recommend?
TransitionUS.org is the national organization, and that will connect you in with a lot that's happening in transition across the country, around the world. Rob Hopkins' blog is TransitionCulture.org. Daily blog, 5 days a week, really excellent. Our website is TransitionColorado.org. And there is also a social networking site for the state called TransitionColorado.ning, N-I-N-G, .com.
Well, I'll toss all those links into my blog for this show at ecoshock.info. Our guest on Radio EcoShock is Michael Brownlee. He's a co-founder of Transition Colorado, a transition speaker, writer, and trainer. Michael, I really appreciate talking with you.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity, Alex. It's great to talk with you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Thank you so much for listening. This is Alex for Radio EcoShock. Last year, I started noticing a big change in the people who attended speeches and meetings about former doomer subjects like climate change and peak oil. The crowd used to be mostly older white guys, often with beards. Lately, women are starting to outnumber the men. Here comes another one, a spark plug organizer and people connector, Vandy Savage from Vancouver. Vandy, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex.
You know, I kind of woke up to the gender change at last fall's talk by Kathy McMahon, the peak oil shrink, and incidentally, my recording of Kathy's speech has been downloaded by thousands of people. Why are so many women showing up now?
Well, I think there has been a dramatic shift in what women are doing with their time after their children have mostly grown up. As you know, when we're raising kids and working full-time, that's just about all we can fit into our lives, and most of our activism is around the actual raising and of our children, perhaps volunteering at the schools or volunteering for after-school programs or whatever. But once our kids are adults, or at least in high school, many of us then take our what would be called spare time and turn it toward political activism.
Well, just recently I attended a Village Vancouver meetup, kind of an update on the transition movement here. Women outnumbered men 2-1. Is it partly the practical solutions being offered?
I think that's part of it. I think that women also, the women that you are seeing, grew up in a time when they have been given free rein to be who we want to be. Really, our mothers did not have that social okay to do this. And I do think practical solutions, women, if anything, are pragmatic. Well, how can we actually do that at home, and how do we benefit our communities?
So do you think women see these impending crises differently? Do they feel differently about the bad news that's rolling in?
Yes, I think we absolutely do. At one point, you and I were talking about fight or flight, and the idea that when things get really tough, you either fight your enemy or you run away. And there was a study done at UCLA, about 10 years ago now, where several women sociologists studied what women's response to danger is, and it's not fight or flight at all. In fact, it's community building. The first thing a woman does is say, okay, where are my kids and my husband, my family? Are we safe? Let's gather together. And the second thing they do is they get with other women and basically form a community and make a group decision about what to do. It's not an individual fight or flight. And I think that's what we are now doing for the danger of, you know, global warming and overshoot, overpopulation. We are exhibiting that gathering around and forming community and saying, okay, collectively, what are we going to do?
But isn't there a danger that women will end up back in the gardens and in the kitchens while men run the New Age movements and talk endlessly about what it all means? That's happened before in some back-to-the-land movements. There's a danger we could go backwards.
I am deeply worried about that. When I read Howard Kunstler, I get very concerned because I think there is a danger because we are not fully equal in any society in the world. And so, of course, when things get tough, often people get more conservative and revert to old social systems. And I am worried about that.
We'll be right back in just a minute with more Radio EcoShock.